Welcome to the Centre for Army Leadership podcast. I'm your host, Lieutenant Colonel Dean Canham, heading up the British Army's Centre of Excellence for Leadership. I'm joined for this episode by the former Chief of the Secret Intelligence Service, Sir Alex Younger. Sir Alex's rise to the top of MI6, where he spent 6 years as C, was preceded by roles as the head of counterterrorism and operational roles across the world. Prior to joining MI6, he was in the Army as a private soldier and then as an officer in the Scots Guards. So Alex, thank you so much for coming to join us at the Centre for Army Leadership. We've got a fascinating conversation ahead, I'm sure. What we usually do, though, is start off by asking people about their own personal philosophy or approach to leadership and what they think it might be.
Well, that puts me on the spot. I'm not sure I have a philosophy available. One of the reasons I'm here, I should add, is I really applaud the effort to take a more scientific and learning and a curious approach to leadership and to step back. I emphatically did not do that. I've been a practitioner ever since I was at Sandhurst. But I think if you asked other people what my approach to leadership would be, they would say it is fundamentally, if you're to be positive, empowering. And if they're being negative, they would say lazy. So I think economy of effort, a principle of war, has been something that's very much informed my approach to leadership.
Yeah. And do you think that your approach, the one that you have now, the one you had at various stages of your career, was that forged all the way back from childhood, family, upbringing, or is it something which you're still developing
now? No, absolutely. And so intrinsic to my leadership is a capacity to trust people. So I got where I got to through presuming nobility of intent. Now, on occasions, you are disappointed, but in the vast majority of cases, the people you work for want to do the right thing. And if you assume that in the first instance, obviously, if evidence arises to the contrary, you should act. Mm. If you assume that in the first instance, that's the key to enabling leadership, because it enables you to delegate and empower and put the power next to the information. Mm. And that obviates the effects of hierarchy and makes us all more effective.
Yeah. I apologize for reminding you, but it was over 40 years ago when your sort of first military experiences started to take place. You actually joined the Army as a private soldier in the Green Howards, now in the Yorkshire Regiment, and then went on to more focused leadership training at Sandhurst after that. And you've obviously done a huge amount since then, but what do you remember being your main memories of officer training here or any of the leadership training you got prior to that? And the second part of that question, I guess, is did you think that you were ready by the time you left Sandhurst, went to the Scots Guards and onto operations and leading soldiers?
Well, look, it was a great course and I learnt some really important stuff about how to be an infantry officer in the British Army. But what was really going on, and to the leadership thing, was a bit of a game, if I'm to be honest. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if this is still the situation. But basically, at the beginning of your time at Sandhurst, stuff happens to you. And if the course has been successful and you have developed as a leader, by the end, you are happening to stuff. So you start with no agency at all. And as you're in a bewildering environment, you're getting up really early. There's weird stuff going on. You have to touch your head every time you talk to someone important. And gradually, slowly, you gain control of your environment and you gain a sense of your power and your agency. And I think it is really effective in that respect. And it gives you an extraordinary degree of confidence in the context also of understanding of the need to lead and a humility in the face of everybody else and the talents that they have. So I thought it equipped me well. I mean, the British Army, certainly that I joined, though, was pretty tribal. So it was very intimidating going to a proud infantry regiment like the Scots Guards. You know, everybody seemed to know each other really well. Super confident facade. It is an intimidating environment and it takes you a while to get in and into the inside. But once you're there, of course, it feels like home.
And how did you find the relationship with your NCOs, particularly your Toon Sergeant? I'd imagine first up that the delineation of responsibilities within the platoon, how you saw it happening around the rest of the battalion, whether that worked well or didn't with different characters.
Well, at Sandhurst, I had a remarkable colour sergeant. And in a sense, I was lucky because he was an extraordinary man. I was unlucky because he was from the regiment that I aspired to join, which meant in practice that I was picked on at the beginning and favored at the end. So it was a different experience. And then in the regiment, I mean, trying to explain this to outsiders, how it worked, that you were in charge when the person who reported to you directly was the one who actually knew what they were doing, struck people as esoteric. But we'll come on to this, Dean, I'm sure. And actually, by dint of Sandhurst and the whole serve to lead ethos, understand leadership explicitly in cultural terms. Mm. And so you may be inexperienced of the ways of the army, but you've been selected as someone who is an effective steward and propagator of the right culture. And even then, I understood that as my job as an officer. So whilst it was intimidating, it is really strange to know the least and have the most authority. Mm. It's bizarre stuff. I think I was pretty clear about what I was for.
Yeah. We'll revisit all the stuff in between as we go through this chat. But of course, you ended up as the head of MI6, the Secret Intelligence Service. Do you think that you would have ever done that if you hadn't joined the army? Do you think you can draw a line between early leadership experiences and where you got to?
And I emphatically do not think I would have been chief of MI6 had I not been a platoon commander in the army. I want to be really clear, that is absolutely not the only route to the top in SIS. There are myriad and diverse ways of achieving what I achieved. I'm just talking about my case here. But in my case, I think an early experience of leadership, specifically the need to take responsibility and have agency, and the habituation to the idea that stuff happens when you want it to happen. Mm-hmm. It's extraordinary, and at a really young age, 22, 23, that actually sets you out from your peers. And then there's a very old-fashioned phrase as well, you know, if you want to lead, you need to be able to lead yourself effectively. I was a student when I came here, feckless, frankly. And, you know, it sounds prosaic, but the whole business of getting up early was somewhat alien, and the inculcation of self-discipline was central. But to be clear, I put a different construct on what self-discipline consists of. So it sounds like getting up early in the morning and ironing your shirt. And it is, I suppose, those things. But for me, it's about a quality of alertness. It's a sense of your environment and what is going on, and an alertness to what you need to do next.
Yeah.
And that is a thing you definitely get while you are here.
And that's a skill I had imagined that you relied on then in the early stages of your career in the Secret Intelligence Service.
Yeah, completely. Well. And in fact, this game you play at Sandhurst, trying to sort of get agency, it's largely about being hyper alert to your surroundings and working out what's going to happen next, mm-hmm. because that's the key to economy of effort. You want to be preparing for the next thing, not the last thing.
Yeah.
And in an environment that's unfamiliar, and SIS is nothing if not a place where you have consistent, highly unfamiliar experiences. It is all about your level of ambient alertness, your ability to understand what's going on around you, the human geography in particular, and get ahead of it.
Mm. So if that's a sample of the really useful transferable skills, does anything that really struck you, you did a couple of bits in between, but from leaving the army as a junior leader to then moving across into SIS, is there anything that you thought, oh, that strikes me as having to really needing me to adapt my approach?
Yeah, I mean, it's okay as long as you understand that isn't the only version of leadership in town. I mean, I think it's really important, but it's what we would broadly call sort of Nelsonian crisis top-down hierarchical leadership, where you've got the authority and the stuff you're trying to move around is stuff that you're in charge of, and where there's a relatively clear objective. Now, that is important, but arguably in that environment, it's more important to make a decision than make the right decision. It's a confidence thing. There's another form of leadership, which is essentially complex leadership, which is about sort of program management, essentially, and working your way towards an outcome in a methodical, planned way, which I think comes to you later in the army and is certainly a big part of civilian life. And frankly, it is not my strong point. I will be honest with you. The bit in the middle is where SIS officers live, which is the ambiguous zone, the wicked problem to which there is no real solution, to where most of the options that you've got are mutually cancelling and contradictory, and yet you really have to pursue all of them, and where you've got to rely on the essentially, you know, the right hemisphere of the brain as much as the left, and where crucially you have no power. So as an SIS officer, you are behind the lines. You are in the most vulnerable position you can imagine. You don't have the opportunity to tell anybody what to do. You don't even have the opportunity to tell anyone who you are. It's completely different. But insofar as a career as an SIS officer is fundamentally contingent on your understanding of human nature and your ability to build relationships, different environment, but I found my experience in the military also to be invaluable in that respect.
And noting that you won't be able to share details of your operational experiences, I should imagine that having a sense of perhaps being led when you might be isolated and feeling a bit vulnerable and under pressure, and then when you're at the other end of the organization trying to lead people who are dispersed across the world and doing very difficult things, having to make decisions without perhaps direction all the time, that's a unique set of leadership interactions up and down in itself.
Yeah, but there was a really important commonality. So my understanding of what I was taught here was essentially what we would now call values-driven leadership. So a set of principles designed to allow you to operate in highly stressful and ambiguous circumstances, albeit in a military context. But we spend a lot of time here, and I'm sure it happens now, talking about essentially your cultural responsibilities as an officer and the way in which you are responsible for inculcating that more broadly, recognizing that in ambiguous and isolated circumstances of decision-making, that's what's going to keep the show on the road. That's what's going to keep people safe. When I became chief of SIS, you know, my principal task, to be clear, was to transform the service so that technology was more an advantage to us than to our opponents. But it was really important in an environment of dynamic change to remember what stays the same. And for me, it was the culture piece. And furthermore, you know, we operate in an extraordinarily high-risk environment. The things that trip you up are not things that happened before. They're the new things. They're the unexpected things. So whilst, you know, we are democratically accountable, we obey the law, we're rigorously overseen, the reality is that the thing that's going to trip you up will be a thing for which there isn't a law or a rule. And at that point, you need to rely on individual people's capacity to make the right decision in the context of a common moral framework. And I find, which we call values, I suppose, which I find you just cannot talk about enough. Now, the first place that I spoke about that a lot was here.
Yeah. And the army values are absolutely preeminent in the leadership doctrine, which we ask people to read now as well.
Yes. I mean, I think the values are specific to the mission. So we had a big conversation about what they should be. I suppose the key issue for us specifically in SIS and MI6, even as opposed to our colleagues in the other parts of the UK intelligence community, is we don't have the power of the state behind us, and you know, you're on your own effectively, and specifically therefore we're never going to succeed through might or muscle. We're going to succeed through guile and by outthinking our opponents. And so that was the key value that I sought to get people to understand, that essentially it was our creativity that was going to achieve our mission, not our muscularity.
And I'd imagine that at the most senior level you were probably perhaps quietly, perhaps publicly, challenged on the morality and the ethics of a lot of the work that the agency was doing.
Yeah, so there was a sort of deliberate tension. I mean, you don't, as chief, speak publicly very often, but I mean, ironically, you're the only avowed member of the service, so it does fall on you. There was a problem for me, which is that I come from a community that has dominated the service, but where we're, as you've said, intent on broadening it out as quickly as possible. And I had to have a go at displaying what we are, which is humans, and to talk about our human qualities and try and give a sense that the people who act in the public's name possess those qualities. So more than you would expect in the public pronouncements of a spy, I spoke about our values. But I was super keen, and I generally said this explicitly, that our enemies should under no circumstances mistake that for weakness. On the contrary, I regard that as a source of strength.
Yeah.
And I was very clear, and my successor is too, that you know, we are mission-focused people, will be implacable in pursuit of those who mean our country harm, but we're not the same as our enemies.
Mm. And on that point about people who would wish to harm the nation, the UK, you were, before being head of MI6, you were director of counterterrorism for a number of years. What sort of particular pressures does that induce on you as a leader, and those that you're leading, where even the smallest mistake on an individual's part could have catastrophic consequences, but where all of the successes you're having, nobody ever finds out about.
Well, that is, by the way, the downer of the whole job. We're only known through our failures. And I warn anyone contemplating a career that is the downside. But there are many positives upon which I would want to dwell, and I would unhesitatingly recommend a career with us. But you're absolutely right. And terrorism was in some ways pernicious and difficult because it is so personal. You know, it's not actually a strategic threat in the sense that Putin with his nuclear weapons is, but it's a very fundamental challenge to the fabric of our society. And it's incredibly close to home. And of course, the fascinating thing for us was that the battle was being fought on the streets of Miriam Shah or Kabul, but also in the UK. So it puts a huge premium on partnership and ensuring that ego does not get in the way of effective operational collaboration. And I have seen, you know, I've seen opportunities for egos to kill people, and that is not acceptable. But to your question, it feels incredibly personal. It's your home. They're trying to kill your friends and your family and you. And people worry about it. When I was appointed as chief, I was watching a rugby match and, you know, my son's school, and I was with the other parents and they said, congratulations. And I slightly laughed it off and said something self-deprecating. I can't remember what it was, but they just looked at me and said, no, we need you to succeed. And you feel a huge weight of personal expectation. There is, slightly crazily, zero appetite for risk. And that's actually not, it's not possible to generate that in a democracy. And there are huge sort of societal issues around how we don't become terrorists ourselves and make the problem worse, which is what terrorists are seeking to achieve. And then there's a huge premium on personal resilience, because it can just really get you, this stuff. I mean, you will have enjoyed the opening ceremony of the Olympic Games in 2012. It was a great spectacle. You know, I had my head under the duvet.
Yeah.
So nothing is quite the same in those circumstances.
I was there, actually. I found myself running the security angle from a military perspective at the All England Club for the period of the Olympics.
Oh, well, you know what I feel like then.
So I was at the other end of your work without even knowing it, I'm sure. You spoke there about resilience and a lot of the pressures that you would have been under in various roles. How do you manage that yourself to get through the really high pressure periods, which might be quite acute, but then also the cumulative pressure over the number of years that you've been operating that world?
Well, I'm asked this a lot, and I talk to young people, and when I was the chief, I would always include, when I spoke to them, my view that it's about diverse sources of self-esteem. And this is a complicated and difficult message, because we're a vocation and we expect dedication and mission focus. And on some occasions, we expect people to go the extra mile. But if you invest your entire ego and self-esteem in your professional identity, you're making yourself brittle and you're diminishing your resilience. And as humans, what we do is only one part of us. That's even true of army officers. There is lots of other stuff going on. There are relationships and there are interests and there are curiosities and there is the whole gamut. And if you want to be resilient, you need your personality to cross all of those factors. And I have actively work during my time, even at times of extraordinary stress, to make sure that I'm doing all of those bits and that my family is there and that I'm talking to the dog and that I'm going sailing and I'm doing all of those things. And apart from the else, you're a better decision maker and you're more independent. You are you primarily, even as you strive to serve. And that makes you a more objective and independent decision maker.
And given I'd imagine there is an endless amount of work and decisions that people would like you to make, that trust in your senior team around you, delegation, mission command, telling people, this is my intent, go and get on with it. You don't need me to supervise you.
This is how it works as a senior leader, right? So everybody's got a problem, and there are two ways that they can solve the problem. They can solve the problem or they can give it to the boss, right? And at the beginning, you have a queue of people outside the door. And this is particularly true on Friday afternoon, in my experience. They'll want to put their problem on your desk. They'll go away with a spring in their step, thinking you're a wonderful leader, and you'll have a miserable weekend. Now, there are some things that only the chief can do, but they are extremely limited. And my job in 99% of those interactions was to talk sympathetically, make it clear that I trusted the people and that I would back them whatever their decision was, but make sure they left my office with the problem.
Yeah.
And indeed, more than that, I think the key to surviving in a dynamic environment was to, as I think I've already said, to mitigate the effects of hierarchy as much as possible, to delegate power as assertively as you possibly could. And then I'll reflect on my experience, which is that there are remarkably few things that only the top leader can do. I thought when I became the chief, there would be like loads of flashing lights and levers to pull in the cockpit. Now, I'd been head of operations, and broadly speaking, there were quite a lot of flashing lights and levers to pull. If you define a lever, though, as the thing that only you can do, when I became chief, there were only three levers.
Mm-hmm.
And they, broadly speaking, were our vision. So telling the story of what the service is going to be like in 5 years' time so that people understand and smell the prospect of enduring success and are prepared to put up with the disruption of change. Our values, which is a common set of moral expectations of each other, which it's incumbent on you personally to live up to. And our people. And if you make decisions about people that contradict those other two things, you're toast. Mm. So those three levers, our vision and our values and our people, they're now, actually, that means you can delegate quite a lot because most stuff sits underneath those sort of strategic considerations.
Are there one or two operational moments that really stick in your mind? They might have been in the army, more likely probably in your operational service as a spy, that you think, on reflection, that was a really good example of where I made a difference. In leadership terms, I've had a real impact on either a situation or some individuals. And that was a really commendable effort on my part. And then perhaps the more interesting flip side, where it might have gone a bit wrong and you learned from your failure.
Well, plenty of the latter. And if I'm to be honest, whilst I was I thought of myself as a leader in the army, when I joined SIS, I really didn't. At that stage, it's very different now. It was quite a lonely experience in a good way, by which I mean, when I joined, I was working on the wars in Yugoslavia and all the horrors that took place. We were trying to find the people responsible for the terrible crimes that had taken place. And in a way that was wonderful, and I think still broadly is the case, you were just given the task and allowed effectively to design the correct operational approach and to get on with it. And of course, you had already been steeped in the whole business of human relationships. That's what we do. You're trained for that for almost as long as you're trained at Sandhurst. But it's very much this interaction. It's one to one. And you're operating in an environment where you have no power other than basically guile. And you learn a huge amount in those circumstances. Now, some stuff happened to me during that period, which was completely fundamental to my future leadership. But it was really around the content of that leadership, because we basically got disrupted by the invention of the internet. And there was a very bumpy period when we fundamentally realized that changed the rules completely. And there was a sort of shock of adaptation. And the thing about that, which is pretty useful, is it inculcated in me the need always to be learning, including from our enemies, and a fundamental sense that however successful we were, we have to change radically to stay ahead. Now, that became my leadership. But I went on just being an operational officer. I thought of myself as a spy. I thought of management as something else.
Mm-hmm.
Very, very different, therefore, to being an army officer. Probably the end of that period was I ended up in charge in Afghanistan, which did entail, a big chunk of stuff. So I was already in the more traditional sense in charge. And then I went and sat down in my boss's office when I came home, and he said, "You could do my job." And I know this sounds ridiculous to him, but that had simply not occurred to me.
Yeah.
So a lesson I have when you're developing your talent is, for God's sake, tell them. Because it was a surprise to me.
Yeah.
And then it becomes different. And I actually went to do a number of civil service leadership development courses and opportunities. And that was a massive wake-up call, because I was director of counterterrorism at the time. I thought of myself as really special, doing a really cool job. And indeed, what we did was serious and important. But when I saw what other colleagues in government are up to, you know, stewarding primary education, building the transport network, arranging the budget, it puts stuff in perspective, actually. Yeah. And it's a very useful, mind-broadening experience.
Yeah, all things which are equally fundamental to the lives of people in the UK.
That's exactly the point. And we're sort of special in some ways and incredibly proud of our culture and what we do. But it's quite important to remember that out there are a lot of people doing important and esoteric things.
Yeah. You mentioned technology a couple of times and how the internet changed your role. And you write and talk often about technology, cybersecurity, etc. At the moment, do you think that technological advances, as they continue, will benefit leaders in their leadership? Or do you think it's a distraction or a hindrance to what remains essentially a human-centered phenomenon?
So I really think that's a false choice. And people spend the whole time going, oh, MI6 is going to go out of business because it's all digital these days. I point out somewhat forcefully that cyber is the interaction of man and machine. It's a human technological phenomenon. Many of the weaknesses in cyberspace are human-derived. Many of the opportunities are technically derived. Success is absolutely working in the middle. So my principal experience of technology is that it imposes a huge premium on partnership that didn't exist before. So I talked about what a kind of oddly lonely life it was to be a young spy. That isn't the case anymore, because now the business is far more complex. You're reliant on a whole set of stuff. Because what does technology do? It just destroys boundaries. You know, we used to make a distinction between domestic and international, or peace and war. Our law is written on that. NATO is, Article 5 is founded on it. But all these concepts are fundamentally rendered moot by tech. Now, leadership to a large degree, if you're not thinking about it very hard, relies on boundaries. I think there's, you know, in military terms, there's an area of operations, or whatever you might call it, you know, to keep things simple. But inconveniently, tech crosses all those boundaries. And that hit us first in the covert world, because courtesy to the Russians, we saw that the hybrid war and the gray space were decisive in mediating a lot of our security stuff before you ever got to fighting a war. And if you sat around arguing about whether this was a home or foreign thing or a cyber or real thing or a war or peace thing, as does happen, by the way, the enemy going to win. Yeah. So leadership suddenly becomes about giving power to other people. And that isn't what it traditionally is supposed to feel like. It's about putting a premium on people who demonstrate the capacity to subordinate their ego to the broader endeavor. It's about remaining incredibly proud of what you do and keeping a collective ethos whilst, as you've said, reminding everyone that they actually work for the king, not for the chief. And these are, to my mind, extraordinarily different leadership responsibilities. But it's why I go back to values. They don't change that stuff. Mm. You know, the reason I was so keen to transform us was so that we could stay the same, ironically.
Yeah. So back to values, ethics, and morality. Are we edging towards a point where we ever get to the point where technology is taking over ethical, moral decisions that humans might otherwise have made previously?
Well, I mean, that is obviously the big question. The, you know, where is human agency left with the increasing capacity of autonomous machines, specifically artificial intelligence, to act in a human-like way? You know, they're not humans. This is pattern recognition. They're mimicking humans. Good AI is AI that fundamentally complements the human condition and helps us do the things we're better at and taking away the stuff we're not. Bad AI essentially substitutes for humans, and we should be very cautious about it. So there is definitely a risk, particularly when it comes to military technology, that the demands of autonomy ultimately undermine the framework in which we apply force that we should already be alive to. But then there's actually some really good conversations going on, for instance, about keeping humans in the nuclear loop, which include the Chinese, interestingly. So, you know, I think everybody understands the risks of going there. And my view on this is we've absolutely got agency in this space. The idea of robots taking over the world, there are some choices in there which we can really make one way or the other.
So perhaps that's a good link to talking about robots taking over the world. You would have had experiences all the time working with, talking to, briefing very senior people, particularly across UK government, and you would have watched them having to make very difficult decisions based on the information that you're giving them or the recommendations, perhaps. Do you think that the pressures of leadership, not necessarily just political, but across other government departments, people are well prepared for? And do you think that leadership specifically, not just in terms of heading departments or parties, but the skill and the art of leadership is something which the public still really value and recognise?
It's a very good question, because I'm sure if you looked at it technically, the amount of money spent on management training specifically has probably gone up a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I, by the way, really welcome that. I think that's great. And I think we should be much more purposeful and thoughtful. If it's in the paradigm, the rather old-fashioned paradigm that I'm implying, which actually sort of explicitly centers around the moral responsibility that you carry, that's a message you've got to project very carefully. I think it can sound like an attempt to entrench an existing approach, an existing power structure, an existing cadre, which it shouldn't be. I think, you know, essentially the expectations we have of each other are universal. But I think it's important for us to be able to speak about it in a way that people are going to be able to relate to. But I don't resile from it. And I mean, at the very heart of this, when you look at, you know, the future of our country and our value system, the stuff that we do, there's a way that we do things that I think is good. So I'm not a relativist. You can't be a successful spy or, I think, a successful soldier without being a relativist. I think the fact that our government is accountable to its people is a good thing. And you know, so there's some quite hard stuff in the middle that probably needs to stay there, even as you talk about a learning and empowering, you know, fundamentally humble approach. I think there's some things that we just need to remember we've got and we need to hold on to and we should be proud of.
Yeah, I'm sure there were probably conflicts, perhaps either outwardly or just in your own mind, when you disagreed with senior people around government, and that was a particular leadership challenge for yourself to go back to the building and brief your people and say, actually, they're not doing what we've recommended. They've chosen to do this instead.
Yeah, although it's a bit asymmetric with us. I mean, the beauty of being a spy is... this isn't so much dealing with our own government where everything's written down and formal, but of course, often you're dealing with other countries and you're a way of having a conversation in a way that won't be reflected in the formal political discourse. And you can be extraordinarily frank in those circumstances. Chief of MI6, you can be used to just say stuff to people in a way that you wouldn't normally get away with. And when it comes to government, look, I've talked about the value of creativity, which we hold dear. Another one is courage, and that isn't just about being brave in difficult circumstances. But the most important element of courage in my business is speaking truth to power. And an intelligence service is useless, unless it's prepared to do that. And most intelligence failures derive from that. So that is central to our interaction. And you asked me whether I flunked things in my career. The ones I can remember is where I've fallen short there. And the thing to do then is to bottle it and remember what it feels like, because you know inside that you have not really thumped home the message that the politician does not want to hear because you want that person to like you.
Yeah.
And the great thing about having a set of values that are very explicit is that it makes it much harder to flunk it. And there'll be a few, you're sitting across the prime minister in the national security table, you every fiber in your being wants to say something that makes them feel happy, and you can't do that.
Mm.
And it's much easier if you've sort of had a conversation with everybody about the fact that that just makes an intelligence service useless if you do that, and that you the space for you to fail that test is reduced.
Yeah. So probably less often now you'll find yourself in those very high-pressured, difficult briefings and situations, and you can perhaps take a slightly more relaxed, elevated view of the world. What do you think are the real challenges, perhaps particularly in terms of leadership, but more generally for the nation at the moment?
Well, I think this is a truism, and it sounds platitudinous, but we are, there's a shift going on, and we're moving to a truly multipolar world where the last 30 years are a particularly unreliable guide to the future. The last 30 years were essentially the unipolar moment based on the broad application of US power, allowing the international rules-based system, as we called it, to prosper. And increasingly, that's going to be contested. And we're going to be in an environment where we're either in active competition with implacably opposed countries like Russia, or reasonably enough, a global South that is pretty well determined to plough its own course. In short, it's a much more complicated and contested environment where what we think of as the default, which is basically Western values, aren't going to apply automatically. And as the UK, of course, you know, we've got an incredibly resilient and extraordinary capacity to adapt. And our history shows, you know, small island in Northwest Europe, we can achieve extraordinary things if we properly understand what's going on around us. And I think that's the challenge we face as a country, because we're a status quo power. It's hard for us to accept that the rules have changed, but they fundamentally have. And it's that kind of smelling the coffee moment that I think needs, you know, that's what will make us successful. We will be fine if we recognize the world we work in and live in is profoundly different.
Yeah. And MI6 will need great people to steer us through those difficult times, as the army will as well. And you've alluded to it already, that it's much broader in its intake of individuals, skills, and diversity. What are the sort of top tips or steering points you would give to anyone who's listening to this and thinking, oh, maybe that's for me?
Don't believe the fiction, for a start. So the fiction is designed to create an image of a place where nobody in their right mind would think that they would feel at home. Mm-hmm. And the absolute opposite is true. In my experience, the intelligence community is full of members of the public doing extraordinary things. And so anybody who's sitting at home, not being able to imagine themselves in that world, should think again. Mm-hmm. It is an extraordinary mission, and secrecy makes for a different place. But actually, it's kind of the best of what's all around us condensed into that environment. And speaking personally, it's been a hugely satisfying career. There's a shorter distance between what you do and stuff happening in the business of intelligence than almost anywhere else. And if you're someone who aspires to make a difference, it's a pretty extraordinary place to be.
And you miss it?
No. No, I really
done your
don't.
Time.
I really don't. I really loved it. I'm proud of what I did. I made mistakes. I did some things right. It was 30 years, but it's also liberating to be out, to be not subject to the discipline and burden of secrecy, to be able to think about other stuff. But also, I enjoyed talking about the way the world is, not based on any secrets that I know, but based on my experience of the reality of how states and individuals behave in these sort of extreme circumstances. So I feel like I've got plenty to do.
Yeah. And what sort of things are you falling back into now that you wouldn't have had the time or capacity to do previously?
That's a very good question. I mean, my sort of obsession is around technology and that being more of an advantage to kind of democracy than autocracy. So I'm quite heavily involved in tech companies and non-profits that sort of lobby to that end. But I've also followed the advice that I gave our young officers and created space in my life. And it is remarkable, I suppose, and this is a leadership lesson, what original thinking can do. And with hindsight, when I was in office, particularly senior office, original thinking was hard because you're just so busy.
Yeah.
And I've probably had more original thoughts since I left, unfortunately, than I managed while I was there.
Because you've had the time and space to actually think about them.
Mm.
So as we start to just draw to a conclusion, a few potentially quick-fire questions, but you can answer them as quickly or as long as you like. Who's the best leader that you've actually worked with or alongside?
Well, I think I'm a nightmare. I was thinking about this. I'm a nightmare employee. So basically, the best leaders I ever worked for were people who let me do what I wanted to do and backed me up when it went wrong. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And is there somebody you would read about or a character from history that you would identify as a leader that you respected?
No, absolutely not. And that's another reason why I commend what's going on here. I think I've already explained, I kind of came into leadership from the bottom up and I didn't have the chance to take a kind of holistic view and to learn. When I joined the Scots Guards, we had a rather extraordinary, slightly terrifying commanding officer who'd fought in the Falklands called John Kisley, and he gave us all a copy of Defeat into Victory by Bill Slim, which I was thinking of claiming as being my principal guide, but I confess I never actually got to the end of it. But I can see where he's coming from, I must say.
Okay. And media-wise, now do you draw on more traditional, or I suspect perhaps more modern sources for interest, personal development?
No, I mean, I now love, having not really taken much interest in it, delving into the history of the sort of stuff that I was involved in. You know, we were kind of making the history.
Yeah.
It's been fascinating to sort of turn it round. I keep myself current now with just following a whole set of people.
Yeah.
And these sort of chronic conversations you can get engaged in now are absolutely fascinating. And you can sort of feed your curiosity in this environment in a way that's extraordinary. And I love doing that. And it drives my wife mad because she thinks that I'm not doing anything.
Yeah.
But I promise her I am.
Final question then, looking back, what's the one bit of advice you would give to a young Alex as he set off on his leadership journey?
Yes, there's a problem. So I did do a bit of leadership education, and I was taught the importance of learning and humility and empathy and authenticity. And those are all really important things. But to slightly go against that, the advice I would give the young Alex is, if you're right, if you think you're right, you probably are. And there's a horrible weakness, particularly in Britain, with our hierarchies, that conflates seniority with knowledge. And actually, in my experience, people who really understand what's happening are the people with the least power, the most junior. So if you're at that level, you're the person who knows what's happening, you're probably right. So please say so.
So, Alex, it's been a fascinating conversation, which we could extend for hours and hours, but I know that the listeners will really appreciate it. Thanks very much for coming in and spending time with us.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
So Alex's captivating and varied career experiences give him an almost unique insight into leadership across a vast spectrum of roles and responsibilities. There is a clear theme throughout, though, which is his advocacy for values-driven leadership as the foundation for success, particularly in ambiguous situations. And he describes values as a common set of moral expectations. He emphasised that trust between leaders and their teams is fundamental to collective success, and that it enables the necessary delegation of power to those who know a situation best and who are therefore best placed to act on it. So Alex spoke about having a bias for action, whereby leaders must generate and use their agency to make things happen, and that self-leadership is the foundation on which to be able to do so. He told us that an alertness to the human geography of situations that surround leaders is the best way to identify and act on the most appropriate course of action, especially when there is rarely an obvious right one. Finally, Sir Alex spoke about the importance of leaders maintaining diverse sources of self-esteem in order to forge their personal resilience, and of generating space for original thinking in their organisations in order to keep them relevant.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the podcast, then please share it with colleagues and friends and add your thoughts to the debate on social media. For more information on British Army leadership or to get in touch with the team, search for the Centre for Army Leadership website or find us on all your main social media platforms.